A few minutes today on what's going on at the Defense Department, headed up by an increasingly blunt Secretary Robert Gates. Here he is speaking to the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense yesterday about the risks of imposing a no-fly zone over Libya.
There's a lot of, frankly, loose talk about some of these military options, and let's just call a spade a spade. A no-fly zone begins with an attack on Libya to destroy the air defenses. That's the way you do a no-fly zone.
Those comments yesterday followed a speech Gates delivered last Friday to the cadets at West Point. He made this frank warning.
Any future defense secretary who advises the president to again send a big American land army into Asia or into the Middle East or Africa should have his head examined.
And there was also this.
And I must tell you, when it comes to predicting the nature and location of our next military engagements, since Vietnam, our record has been perfect. We have never once gotten it right. From the Mayaguez to Grenada, Panama, Somalia, the Balkans, Haiti, Kuwait, Iraq, and more, we had no idea a year before any of these missions that we would be so engaged.
What's going on? Greg Jaffe covers the Pentagon for The Washington Post and joins us from their studios. Greg, your thoughts on these comments?
Gates has traditionally been a pretty blunt Secretary of Defense. I think what we have here is we have a whole string of them kind of put together in a fairly concentrated time period, which we haven't had before. So maybe that's a little bit different. That's why we're noticing it. He's a guy who's entering his sort of swan song here. You know, this might be a moment where he feels like he can be a little bit more blunt. I mean, he's on his way out the door.
Yeah. Well, still, never got it right. You heard the nervous laughter there from the cadets at West Point. And what Gates was saying was, we never knew going in what we were getting into. And, you know, critics were quick to pounce. Here's Jack Wickham and Glenn Arm in the Baltimore Sun. They write, you can argue past policies as you will, but for a U.S. Defense Secretary to baldly state that there are no conditions under which he and his administration would take up arms against a sizable foreign power is very dangerous talk. They're referring, of course, to saying that anybody who would put a big American land army in Asia or anywhere else would have his head examined. Jack Wickman and Glenn Arm go on to say, in the middle and late 1930s, British government leaders made speech after speech about how they couldn't afford even a small war on the continent. Adolf Hitler tested them and found that they were as good as their word. They're pretty much accusing Secretary of Defense Gates of being the sort of British appeasers leading up to World War II.
It's kind of ironic, too, particularly since Gates, I think, has been one of the most forceful advocates for the current surge of troops that we're seeing in Afghanistan. And he's been a forceful advocate for not pulling out too quickly.
So what do you think he is saying? And by the way, let's just throw in another soundbite here. He was on Capitol Hill yesterday, as we said, talking about Libya, in fact. And we expected him to be grilled about this West Point speech on Friday, but he was really only asked one question. And here's what he said in response to a question about, you know, what did you mean about that comment about anybody would have to have their head examined if they thought they could send a big American land army into another country?
What I said at West Point was, in the context of sending a large land army into Asia or into the Middle East. And by that I meant the kind of land army that we had in Germany during the Cold War.
Greg Jaffe, does that clear things up for you?
No, not really. I do think that what he's hinting at, and maybe not saying so bluntly, is that we probably have to get out of the business of occupying countries in the Middle East and Central Asia, particularly Muslim countries. The strain on our force is difficult, and the public opinion at home is negative.
We asked military analyst Andrew Basevich, who's based here at Boston University, has been on the show many times, for his thoughts. Now, just to remind people, he's been a long critic of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. His son was killed in Iraq. But he is a military man. And here's what he said about what Secretary Gates said last Friday at West Point. In effect, Gates is declaring an end to the global war on terror. That is, regardless of how long it takes to wind down Afghanistan, once we finish there, it's fini, done, over. To the extent that Gates' counsel holds, then there won't be an Operation Yemeni Freedom, Somali Freedom, Saudi Freedom, Iranian Freedom.
Yeah, I don't think he's too far off. I mean, in that speech, he also goes on to say that the army's going to get smaller. and will have to move to a different kind of footprint, which is more of an advisory kind of special forces role. Actually, I think what Gates and Basevich, who disagree fundamentally on most issues regarding our foreign policy, I think they tend to agree on this one.
Well, and Professor Basevich also said that if this is true, the next question is, what's next? Is anyone asking that question? If, in fact, you know, we're getting the signal of the end of the war on terror, what does that mean?
I'm not sure they would call it the end of the war on terror, but I think they would call it a different kind of fighting from what we've traditionally seen. And as to what it means, it's a really difficult and good question. I mean, the Pentagon has a hard time sort of walking and chewing gum. You know, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been so consuming that it's really tough to think about anything that doesn't look like or sound like or feel like those wars. And I think this is to Secretary Gates's credit. He's put the department on a war footing the last 4 years in a way that it hadn't been previously. And I think it's retarded the department's ability to think about sort of what the next conflict is looking like. And I think on his way out the door, he's saying, hey, guys, let's start thinking about that.
Well, is that maybe the point of his statement that, you know, we've never gotten it right because a year before each of these conflicts that he listed and the military never knew going in, and to be fair, neither did many of the lawmakers, is perhaps the shift to intelligence?
I think when we went into this global war on terror, we had this notion that we would have a lot of sort of short, sharp conflicts in which we would use overwhelming firepower to cow this enemy, you know, and we could sort of remake the world as we sought fit. And what we've realized is that the world just doesn't work that way. And there are limits to what our military power can really do. And I think that's one thing we've become cognizant of as a country. I think it's one thing the military has become exceptionally cognizant of. And you see it in the caution with something that to many outsiders looks like a relatively simple mission in Libya with a no-fly zone. You see it in the caution towards that.
Greg Jaffe, again, a Pentagon reporter for The Washington Post. Secretary Gates may have sent another signal out this week. We're not sure, because this week he nominated Lieutenant General John F. Kelly to be his senior military assistant, top position. You write a terrific and very compelling story about General Kelly. He's the highest-ranking U.S. military officer to lose a son or daughter in the war in Afghanistan. His son, a Marine Second Lieutenant Robert Kelly, killed when he stepped on a landmine last November. And right after that, 4 days after that, General Kelly went out and made an incredibly powerful speech that he was scheduled to give without ever mentioning to anyone in the audience that his son had just died. And he talked about how isolated the military was, how separate, you know, this less than 1% that's fighting these wars, separate, isolated from the rest of the country, which really doesn't understand their sacrifice. First of all, what do you think Gates is saying in this appointment?
One of the things about Secretary Gates, and I've noticed this just kind of traveling with him a little bit on trips to Iraq and Afghanistan, I mean, he's very, very emotional about the losses that the U.S. takes. He feels very connected to the troops, and he's not afraid actually to show some of that emotion in front of them. I mean, he looks like such a button-down guy, sort of the ultimate Washington bureaucrat when you see him talk in town. But when he gets out among troops, he really is very emotional about this. And I think he really does want to sort of stay connected to the troops and the families, and wants the department to stay connected to the troops and the families who are fighting and who've lost loved ones. And I think one of the things about General Kelly, he's not just lost a son in the war, but even before he lost a son, the level of his connection to the war was stronger than most generals. I mean, he's a guy who almost on a weekly basis, if not more, would go to Bethesda Naval Hospital to visit with wounded Marines. I mean, he was there more than before his son was killed, more than almost any other general.
Well, and he made a remarkable statement to you in an email, I believe. This is General Kelly. He said, "We are only one of 5,500 American families who have suffered the loss of a child in this war. The death of my boy simply cannot be made to seem any more tragic than the others." He's sort of refusing. And we've had other military fathers say this same thing. You know, you can't make my son more special. It's about the thousands of others as well. And by the way, we'll post your story at hereandnow.org along with photos of the general pinning a Purple Heart on a young Marine who served with his son.
A Lance Corporal who served in his son's platoon. His son was the platoon commander.
Yeah, a young man who lost an arm and still didn't want to get the medal. And the general talked him into it?
It was a lance corporal named Sebastian Gallegos. A buddy of his had stepped on a landmine that killed him. It took off Lance Corporal Gallegos' right arm, and I think he just couldn't fathom accepting an honor for an incident that had killed one of his buddies.
Well, and again, these are troops who've died in Afghanistan. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, speaking to Congress yesterday, commented on Afghanistan 10 years in. Let's listen.
When I took this job on December 18th, 2006, 194 Americans had been killed in Afghanistan. So in 5 years of war, 194. Now the total as of today is 1,045. So you can tell when the real fight began in Afghanistan. And most of that additional, almost 1,000, have come in the last couple of years.
And Greg Jaffe, as you pointed out, that's when the surge happened, and he of course, an architect of the surge. And we point out, of course, that Afghans being killed in huge numbers, NATO forces acknowledged this week accidentally killing 9 boys, I think, under the age of 12 who are out gathering wood. How much is this feeding into today's debate on Libya and this huge push by some in the U.S. to go and help the opposition more, the opposition asking for not just a no-fly zone, but for bombing of Gaddafi's forces? You know, it sounds as if you have a Defense Department saying, hold on here.
Yeah, I think one of the things the Defense Department has learned painfully over the last decade is that there is no kind of such thing as surgical bombing. I mean, there's no such thing as painless war. I mean, after the Kosovo campaign, you know, a campaign that we waged without losing a single casualty, I think there was this feeling that you could – these things were relatively quick and easy thanks to technology. You know, you take out a few air defense sites, you knock out a few tanks, you know, voila, you get the outcome that you want. I think Iraq and Afghanistan have shown that they tend to be much longer, more messy, and more violent than you ever think they're going to be.
Well, but what about those who say, who do point to Yugoslavia or the early no-fly zones in Iraq that worked and say, why is Libya different?
The Libyan air defenses are more sophisticated than the Iraqi air defenses. That said, I think the Air Force could take them out and could enforce a no-fly zone. But I think you're also kidding yourself if you think it can be done without casualties or without some civilian casualties, too. I don't think it's unrealistic to think that somebody like Gaddafi wouldn't pack civilians around these air defense sites, essentially daring the U.S. to either take out the air defense sites and kill the civilians or put its own pilots at sort of extreme risk.
Well, and then there's the other political argument we don't want to leave out, which is, you know, the Obama administration doesn't want the impression that this is anything but an internal uprising. Greg Jaffe, Pentagon reporter for The Washington Post, also author of The Fourth Star, Four Generals, and the Epic Struggle for the Future of the United States Army. Greg, thanks as always.
Yeah, thank you for having me.